Thank you very much. Good morning. I just survived last night a bar mitzvah of a friend of mine who is Russian, and he's a caterer. And it did not start till about 9:30, 10 o'clock. I think it was... I left before it was over, so we left at 1 o'clock in the morning. It was still going strong. I mean, caviar and vodka and champagne and 50 types of blintzes and blinis and stuff. It was unbelievable. Anyway, so excuse me if I'm a little slow this morning, type of like I'm still recovering. So anyway, what we're supposed to discuss here today is Judaism in a nutshell. It's very difficult. We want to summarize Judaism in about 45, 50 minutes. Maimonides writes in his book Guide for the Perplexed, which is his major work on Jewish philosophy, Maimonides wrote that he asked someone, would you like to know, he says, the purpose of life, the meaning of the world, the meaning of existence, why you are here? And the guy said, yeah, sure, I'd love that. He said to the guy, well, this is going to require a couple of months of study. The guy says, I don't have time for that. So Maimonides says, okay, we can do it in about 2 weeks. How about that? The guy said, no, forget it. Don't have 2 weeks. 2 weeks is a lot of time. So Maimonides says, what if we can do it in about a week? The guy says, a week is rough. I mean, you know, how about, you know, Maimonides says, a day. The guy says, I can't do a whole day. I'll give you an hour. So Maimonides says, is this unbelievable? Right? Here I'm about to tell a person what is an approach. I can't necessarily prove this is the approach, but an approach, the meaning of life, purpose of existence, etc. Guy's not willing to give me even an hour, but that's how it is. There's a story told in the Talmud, Tractate Shabbos, in which it's quite a famous story. Three non-Jews come to two rabbis. One rabbi is known as Shammai, and one is known as Hillel. Hillel and Shammai had different roles in the Jewish people. Hillel was called the Nasi. Nasi means the president of the court. And Shammai was called the Av Beit Din, which means the father or the head of the court. Now, there was a Jewish court, the Sanhedrin, Jewish Supreme Court, and there were two leaders of the court. There was a Nasi and an Av Beit Din, president and the head of the Beit Din. And they had very different roles. The role of the president was to be advocate of the people. The role of the head of the court was to be advocate of the law. And you needed both. In other words, where you have a law system, the law court, the Jewish legal system, and that was not only regarding what might normally be called religious law, it was also regarding every type of activity of the human being on a national and on an individual societal level, every single activity. And consequently, it was necessary to have one person who was advocating for the people and one person advocating for the law, and hopefully through the meshing of these two views and through the court discussing them, you'd get a very beautiful system. So that explains Hillel and Shammai's different approaches. So three non-Jews approach Shammai. First one says to Shammai, I'd like to convert to Judaism. Shammai says, okay. And the guy says, on condition that, I only have to accept the written law, five books of Moses. I'm not interested in the oral law stuff, Mishnah, Talmud, etc. Forget that. Shammai says, get out of here. Threw him out. Does it make the conditions? I mean, can you imagine? I mean, it was actually asked, Chief Rabbi Hertz of England was once asked by a friend of his who said, listen, non-Jewish friend, he says, I'm interested in Judaism, but this kosher stuff is not, I'm not interested in that. He says, I'd like to become Jewish, but I'm not interested in the kosher stuff. Right, so Rabbi Hertz said, look, you know, if you want to become Jewish, you have to accept that too. And he says, what do you mean? He says, in your own congregation, about 50% don't keep kosher. I see them at the restaurants I go to all the time. He says, I'll be like one of them. It's a good point. And he says, why can't I be like one of them? So Rabbi Hertz said, look, he says, you want to become a citizen of England. He says, you become a citizen of England, and you say to the court, I'm interested in becoming a citizen of England. And they say, that's wonderful. He says, however, I'm not interested in the taxation system. Right, everything else, I'll be fine. I'll drive exactly to the speed limit. I will drive, everything will be fine. Just the tax system. And you say to him, you can't become a British citizen if you don't pay taxes. He says, what do you mean? There is a good percentage of English people who do not pay taxes. I'll be like one of them. So he says, what will we say? You don't lose your citizenship by not doing everything. But to become a citizen, you've got to accept everything. Is the distinction clear? In other words, if, for instance, in the United States, I'm not a citizen, but let's say in Australia, if I did not pay taxes, I wouldn't lose my citizenship. On the other hand, if I want to come to Australia and say I'd like to be a citizen, but no taxes, they won't accept that. So Shammai, technically speaking, was correct. This man came to Hillel, and Hillel convinced him, accepted him, and convinced him that, in other words, Shammai was advocating the law. Hillel was looking at the person and saw this person was someone who was sincere, but just a little misguided. And he was able to convince him of the truth and accepted him. And he became a good Jew. A second man came to Shammai and said, I'd like to become Jewish on condition that, you can already, Shammai's eyebrows are already raising, right? And on condition, he says, that I become the high priest at the temple in Jerusalem. So, you know, I'd like to become a citizen of America, but I'd like to be appointed immediately to the Supreme Court, let's say. Right? That's what he says. So Shammai threw him out. Technically correct, legally correct. You mean you want to become the leader? Just like that? So Hillel, however, advocate of the people, detected a certain sincerity in this guy. Maybe the guy loved something about the idea of being this priest. Maybe he loved the idea of the service, the temple service and everything else, and that was what attracted him. And so he eventually he converted him, but convinced him that he was wrong, sincere but misguided. The third is the most famous. The third Gentile comes to Shammai and says, I'd like to convert to Judaism on condition that you can teach me Judaism while standing on one foot. Shammai throws him out. Hillel says, no problems. No worries, mate. I don't know if he was Australian, but probably very many Australian Talmudic scholars believe he was. So Hillel says, no worries, mate. And Hillel says, I will teach you Judaism while standing on one foot. So Hillel said the following. Very, very famous statement. Hillel said, Ma da'alech sane lechavreich lo tavid. That which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend. The rest is commentary, go and learn. So he didn't let him off scot-free. He did say, go and learn. But he encapsulated Judaism in one statement. That which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend. Now, and he says, the rest is commentary, go and learn. So here we now have to try to understand, because putting Judaism in a nutshell is not something I invented. This was invented by Hillel thousands of years ago. And what exactly is Hillel saying? What is he saying? I mean, if someone would come and tell you, an astronomer would say, you'd say, look, could you just like encapsulate astronomy for me in about a minute? And he'll say, certainly. Twinkle, twinkle, little star. The rest is commentary, go and learn. Well, that's very useful, isn't it? Right? I mean, there's a certain truth to it. Right, but it doesn't really, it's not really helpful to me, and in the sense that that I don't even know what he means when he says it. But you see, Hillel, I do know what he means. That which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend. And that actually, of course, is based on a verse in the Torah, Leviticus 19, which says, very famous verse, love your neighbor as yourself. Love your neighbor as yourself, Ahavta l'reacha kamocha, which means look at a neighbor as your fellow human as a self. As a self. One of the commentaries understands it in the following way. Imagine, a lot of us look at other people as type of extras on the set. You know what I'm saying? We're on the movie set. I am the star. And all these other things are all extras. The hire a crowd, rent a crowd. Like, what are they doing on my road? What are they doing on my block? What are they doing in my synagogue? What are they, it's like, and you know, if it obviously, right, I look at them not as self, but as something, right? So I invite someone over. I say, listen, I'm lonely. You want to come over? I'm bored, lonely. You want to come over and watch the cricket on television? It's an advanced form of baseball. You're probably not familiar with it. In any case, he says, I say, would you like to come over and watch cricket on television? It's Australia versus Pakistan. We're going to kill them again. Right, so he says, sure. I said, bring pizza. I've got beer. Right, so he comes over. Bob comes over. We sit down. We start watching the cricket match. You know, after an hour, I'm feeling a lot better because we're winning. Right, and the beer is helpful. Right, and I say to Bob, I said, listen, I don't need you anymore, you can leave. And he says, I beg your pardon. I said, listen, read my lips. I don't need you anymore, you can leave. When I asked you to come over, I said, look, I am bored and lonely, I'd like you to come over and watch with me. I am no longer bored, I am no longer lonely, I no longer need you. So Bob is not necessary anymore. So how are you treating Bob in this situation? As a self? Love your neighbor as a self? Or as an object to provide me with companionship, pizza, etc. right? That is unfortunately how a lot of people look at the world. And it's a very beautiful idea to know that love your neighbor as yourself, to understand that the other person, the other, is also a self, also is a self, and also has needs and wants and desires and all types of stuff, right? In fact, when we use the term very often, when we think of love and we use the term love, one of the ways in which we use it is quite incorrect. I think it was Shakespeare who first used it this way. We often refer to loving food. You ever heard that expression? I love this, I love that. So, you know, last night, they also had sushi. Sushi seems to be standard now for all Jewish events, even though they're Russians, and Russia and Japan, not exactly friends, but okay. Right, so you go to a restaurant, and the waiter comes over and says, so what would you like? So I said, I love salmon. I just love salmon. So he says, so, therefore? I said, well, I'd like the salmon. And he says, you love salmon, do you? I said, yeah. It's getting a little weird here. And he says, you really love salmon? I said, yes, I do. I love salmon. And he says, get up and come with me. Right? So I get up. He says, come here. Grabs my jacket, takes me to the back of the restaurant. Right? There's a tank, fish tank. In the tank, he says, what is that? I say, it's a salmon. He said, Mr. Salmon Lover, does it look happy to you? I say, well, I've never seen a depressed fish. I would say it looks happy. He says, do you know what I'm going to do if you order salmon? I have a clue. He says, well, I'm going to take it out of the tank. It's going to drown. Right? I'm going to whack it on the head, gut it, skin it, kill it, skin it, whatever. Right? And I'm going to fry it and set it and serve the charred carcass to you on a plate. You love salmon? If you loved salmon, you'd buy the tank and dump it back in the Hudson. Or the Atlantic, whatever. So when the person says, I love salmon, do they really love salmon? What do you mean when you say, I love salmon? You don't love the salmon. If you love the salmon, you wouldn't kill it and gut it, right? I mean, that's not an expression of love, at least not in, you know, normal, you know, psychological modality, right? Right? So what does that mean? The answer is, as Rav Dessler says, what we mean is, I love myself. And I deserve the sensation of eating charred salmon carcass. It pleases me. Right? So in other words, what we mean by I love salmon is I love me. And Rav Dessler says it's exactly what we often mean, not anyone here, but a lot of people will sometimes mean when they say I love him or her, you know what they mean? I love myself. And the social, physical, economic, and psychological benefits I get from my relationship with him, her, are pleasing to me. And if they have to suffer a bit for it, so be it. Unfortunately, that is not what we mean by love your neighbor as yourself. Because yourself is a real self. You're not just a salmon, right? A self is a real self. And in that sense, we understand that love your neighbor as yourself is very, very central. Because the development of a human being has to be to reach beyond the self. We have to understand, however, and of course, if a person is totally self-centered, they really cannot make progress in terms of anything moral or spiritual, because everything will always be measured by pleasing to me, not pleasing to me. And that's obviously not going to be a good measure in terms of morals and ethics. It's going to be a Nietzschean type of standard, which is not going to be pleasant, at least for everyone else. So we can understand that it's a very central idea. We understand that. The question we have to ask, though, is how is all of the Torah a commentary on this? All of Judaism is a commentary on that idea, love your neighbor as yourself. That which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend. The idea that just as there's a set of things that I hate, there's a set of things that you hate. And I don't like those things being done to me. You don't like those things being done to you. And therefore, keep that in mind. That's a very beautiful and important principle. And if we'd all act according to that, we'll be a lot better place. However, how is all of Judaism a commentary on that? How is fasting in Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, a commentary on that which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend? How is lighting Shabbos candles a commentary on that which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend? How is refraining from lobster a commentary on that which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend? It's hard to see that. As I understand it being central, I don't understand how it's everything is a commentary. So I think the key to this can be found in the commentary of Rashi. Rashi, very great biblical scholar. Rashi lived, it's actually interesting, I was talking to a kid at a school, and asked him, when did Rashi live? Rashi was a great biblical commentator. He wrote, actually not just biblical, he wrote commentary on the 24 books of the Bible, the entire Mishnah, Talmud, two-thirds of the Midrash, the Siddur. He wrote responsa, he wrote poems, he wrote commentary on the prayer book, and he had many students. He was a rabbi of most of France, wrote letters to all over the world, and ran a vineyard to make a living. I asked this kid, when did Rashi live? He said, during recess. I said, during recess? He said, yeah. I said, what did your teacher tell you? He said, Rashi lived from 1040 to 1135. So I said, okay, right, okay, we've got some educational issues here. But first of all, they have too long a recess, but aside from that. So Rashi says the following. That which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend. He says, friend has to be understood in a little more expanded version than what we narrowly think. He says, we have a number of friends, or a number of categories of what we call friend. A number of categories. The most obvious and simple category of friend is my fellow human being, each other. That's a friend. But it's interesting to note, in Jewish tradition, God is also called our friend. One of the beautiful songs we sing on Shabbat is Yedid Nefesh Av Harachamam, which means friend, beloved of the soul, Father of mercy. God is called our beloved. Lecha Dodi, we sing on Friday night, Lecha Dodi Likrat Kala, which means, let us go, my beloved, and greet the Sabbath bride. To whom are we talking when we, the Jewish people, say, let us go, my beloved, and greet the bride? Who are we talking to? Answer is, we're talking to God. We're saying, God is my beloved, our beloved. If you look at the beautiful book, Song of Songs, King Solomon's book, Song of Songs, which is a beautiful love poem in which sometimes the man is talking, sometimes the woman is talking. It's a love poem between a man and a woman representing the symbolizing the relationship between God and the Jewish people. It is incredible, and there's probably more commentary on every word of that than any other book of the entire Bible, right? Because it's so deep with symbolism. It's just amazing to read. Song of Songs refers to God and the Jewish people as beloved, as lovers, as closest friends you can imagine. So therefore, in a second way, right, there's a second category of friend who we would define God as my friend. And there is a third category, which maybe is even closer than my fellow human being, maybe even closer than God. There's a third category of friend. What would be the third category of friend? Well, within each of us, we know that we are a very complex being. We're not just merely chemicals. Most people believe that. There is some discussion about it, but I mean, we are more than that. We believe that in addition to all of the interface, which is the intellect, is the interface, according to Jewish tradition, it's not independent. It's an interface between the physical and the spiritual. It is that which connects the physical world and the spiritual world, and the spiritual world is the soul, what's called in Hebrew the neshama, the soul. And in the morning, we said, I said this morning, and probably some of you said this morning, the very beautiful prayer which we start every day with, Elokai, my God, the soul that you have placed within me is pure. You formed it, you blew it into me, and you guard it within me. And in the future, you'll take it from me. Right? And I give thanks to you that you gave me the soul. In other words, me, I say, God, the soul you placed within me is pure. Who's me? We believe that me is not just the soul, because if so, that verse wouldn't make sense, would it? I mean, if the self, if you are the soul and that's it, then how could you say the soul you place within me is pure? What do you mean within me? If I'm the soul, then who's talking? Is the question clear? Right? So evidently, there's a personality, there's the body, there's the physical, and that's something. And it's not, we don't ignore that. Judaism is not into ignoring that, not into self-flagellation a la Da Vinci Code type of stuff, the chalice and whipping and stuff like that. You know, you look at, we have like, the Bible ordains one fast day out of the year, approximately 85 days where you have to feast. I mean, it gives you an idea of what Judaism's about, you know what I mean? Like, right, just in terms of proportion, right? So we don't ignore the body. The body is central and it's essential and it is part of our essence. But the closest partner of my body, so to speak, is really the soul. And we have to achieve a level, as Maimonides puts it, where the soul and the body are not in conflict. The soul and the body are in harmony. Doesn't always happen, a lot of people, right? The soul and the body, usually, with a lot of people, are not in harmony, right? What they are is in conflict, right? As Augustine put it, great Christian thinker. He said, the body mourns, the soul rejoices. The soul mourns, the body rejoices. He believed that was the natural state of humanity. We don't agree with him on that, but we do agree that that's what sometimes people feel, right? That maybe the body wants to eat, the soul wants to pray. Maybe the body wants to sleep, the soul wants to listen to the class, right? Maybe, and who knows, right? There's a lot of conflict in many different ways. We believe that my closest friend, therefore, is my soul. So therefore, if we understand friend in a much broader sense than merely another person, which is also important, then we can understand what Hillel is saying. There are three legs that hold up the world, three bases of our existence. The three bases of our existence are, we're all in the area of relationships and awareness. And they are three relationships. The relationship with myself, my own soul, the relationship with others, and the relationship with God. So each of those is absolutely vital and essential. And without one of the three, we have not got anything. So we need all three: relationship with others, relationship with the soul, and relationship with God. And ultimately, that's all of Judaism. When you think about it, that is all of Judaism. All of Judaism is a commentary on that idea. That which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend. What do you mean, my friend? God, the soul, and other people. Imagine if we would go through life, and every time I make a decision, I mean, obviously not, you know, I mean, major, minor, I mean, there are lots of decisions which maybe are not that significant, the cinnamon or the chocolate, you know, whatever, that type of thing. But of great significance, but we'd always take into account, we'd say, that which is hateful unto me, don't do unto my soul. Don't damage the soul. Why should I only be concerned about the body? I'm concerned about the soul. Don't damage my fellow person. Don't hurt that fellow person. And don't go against God's will. So in other words, if we all of the Torah, all of Judaism, ultimately a commentary on that central concept. Let me try to explain each one. Relationship to self, to others, and to God. Is this clear so far, that what Hillel is saying? I think that's what Hillel is saying. So if you want to encapsulate Judaism, it's about relationships. That's what it's about. Relationships. And three central relationships. It's about, you know, and it's interesting. We believe that relationships are never, there's never a point. We have an Ask the Rabbi website, asktherabbi.org. You may have seen billboards in Manhattan. Just ask. Right, that's us, right? So Gateway. So someone asked me, I get a lot of questions from Christians. And someone asked me the following question. They said, they're quoting a verse from, I think it's Mark 10, 26, something like that. It talks about being saved. And he says, what is the Jewish concept of being saved? Being saved. So I said to him, we have no such concept. Only time Jews talk about being saved is when they just hit save on the file. Right? I'm saved! Right? That's the only time I'm happy that I saved. What do I mean? And I explained to him what I mean by that, because I said there's no particular point at which I can say I'm saved and that's it, I can relax now. There's no particular point at which I can say, okay, I've done this, or I believe this, or I've confessed that, or I've said this, that's it, I'm saved. There's no such thing. Right? What there is always a development of that. My relationship, you know, you could be married for 30, 40, 50 years, people who are married, you're continuously building and developing that relationship. Right? Is there a point where you can say, I'm saved? Right? I mean, some people would say, there you go, okay, whatever. Right? But divorce lawyer, whatever. But I mean, you know, I'm saved. But in general, right, you have to develop. Right, you have to develop in all these three areas, and we grow in our sensitivity. We grow in our understanding. You know, when a couple is first engaged, you know, they first get married, right? They don't have telepathy at that point, but eventually they do. You get to a point where there's total, you know, I mean, you get to a point where there's a development of that. I don't mean telepathy in the sense of a paranormal phenomenon, but where you basically know what each other wants, right? You walk into the bookstore, you both look at each other. Of course, yes, right. You know, and that's it's a great level of communication there, right? And so what are these three areas? Relations, that's what Judaism is, these relationships. It's all about relationships, sacred relationships. And it's interesting, by the way, if you look at this, you look at the Ten Commandments. You look at the Ten Commandments. So was there a problem legally putting it up here? Okay, just wondering. All right, so it's America, who knows? Right, so anyway, in the Ten Commandments, you'll probably notice that there are two tablets, as we know, two tablets. The first five and the second five. First five are in one tablet, second five are another tablet. What are the first five? I am God, took you out of Egypt. You shall have no worship do not worship gods of others in my presence. No, prohibition against idolatry. Don't take the name of God in vain. Keep the Sabbath, and honor your parents. Second five is don't murder. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal, which really means kidnapping, ultimate theft, right? And don't bear false witness, don't lie, and do not covet, don't be jealous. So it's type of interesting, you think about that. How would you divide the first five and second five? Most people would say between man and God, between man and man. Not correct. Because what's honor of parents is number five, correct? I mean, they are people. I like to tell my kids I'm superhuman, but between you and I, we're actually, I'm a human, right? We're people, right? So what does that mean? So I would say it works like this. The first five are between you and your creator. Either your immediate creators, your parents, or your ultimate creator, God. And the second five are between you and your peers. But it's type of interesting, they are based on certain principles. And I think the principles of these three areas, which I mentioned, relationship to others, relationship to God, relationship to self, are there in the Ten Commandments. I am God, in other words, relationship to the Creator. And in addition, and of course, acknowledgement of God's existence. And on the other side, what is that parallel on the human side, peer side? What's the first one of the second five? It's hard to picture this without seeing it. First one of the second five is don't murder. Don't murder, right? So in other words, ultimate negation of the other person, okay? So the first principle is acknowledge the other. Acknowledge God, acknowledge the other. Ultimate lack of acknowledgement of the other, I mean on the extreme, extreme level, is murder, right? God, acknowledge the other, first principle. So that's relationship to God, relationship to other people. The next one is, right, don't worship idols. What does that mean? There's a sacred relationship between us and God. What is the second one on the human peer side? Don't commit adultery. In other words, sacred relationship. Okay, there's a sacred relationship with God. There's a sacred relationship with others. Right, the third is don't take the name of God in vain. Don't steal. In other words, respect for the other person's property. God's property in the sense, his name, his honor in this world, and the other person's property. We have don't bear false testimony. Don't lie. Keep Shabbat, which is, of course, our testimony of God's presence in this world by keeping Shabbat. The last ones are a little strange. Honor your parents. That's the honor to the Creator, the parents. And what is the other one? Don't be jealous. Where do we see that? I think the answer there is, I heard from a good friend of mine, David Foreman, the answer to that is, what that means is acknowledgement of self. Acknowledgement of self. We start off with acknowledgement of the other, God, and the other person, and we end with acknowledgement of self. Acknowledgement of self is acknowledgement of where I came from, respect and honor for my parents. Acknowledgement of who I am means don't be jealous of the other person. Because you see, very often when I'm jealous of the other person, it's not that I want the specific thing that that person has. What do I want? Not to be me. I want to be them. Right? Like, so you see, it's sad, but you see so many people, teenagers very often will be looking at magazines to see how is so-and-so dressing now. And then everyone will be dressing the same way. Everyone, right? And you see groups. You can always see groups. The truth is you can see it in all levels of society, right? Financial people in Wall Street with very, very loud braces and this specific type of tie, usually bright color with little animals in it, right? That type of thing. And then, you can see another group near them is lawyers dressed slightly differently, right? And whatever. But there, it is sad when a person wants to be someone else. There's a great Rebbe, Kotzker Rebbe, who's a famous Hasidic Rebbe, used to say the following. It's a beautiful statement. I'll say it slowly because it's like a little weird. He said, if I am I, because he is he, then I am not I, and he is not he. But if I am I, because I am I, and he is he, because he is he, then I am truly I, and he is truly he. Okay, acknowledgement of self, of who I am, right? Very important. So therefore we have in the Ten Commandments as well these three ideas. My relationship with God, my relationship with others, my relationship with self. And indeed, the Maharal, one of our great sages of the 1600s, tells us that that is our main focus, is refinement in each of these three areas. For example, when a young child is not really that aware of others, they're not really aware, especially, the younger they are, the less aware they are. An infant An infant is not really doesn't really think of you as a you. You know what I'm saying? You may like to think that way, but the infant just looks at you as this object that either provides liquids or takes them away, depending on the case, right? I mean, basically, that's how the right. So you know, they'll cry, doesn't it? They don't think about you, right? My kid, I mean, my youngest is 5 and a half. He doesn't do this anymore, but he used to, like when he was 2, whatever, 3. He'd wake up in the middle of the night, 3 in the morning. Ah, right. What do you want? He says he'd call Abba. That's Dad. My wife trained him to say that at night. So you'd come in. I'd come in and say, "Well, what do you want?" Right, and he'd say, "I'm thirsty." I mean, who's thirsty at 3 in the morning? Alcoholics and little kids, right? Okay. So he's thirsty at 3 in the morning. You know how it goes. You bring him, you say, so you go to the bathroom, you get a cup of water, right? Could be bothered going downstairs to get the filtered water. I mean, it's only, right? So you know, here you go, right? So he drinks an amount of water which can be only be measured with scientific instruments. It is so small. He takes a molecule of water, one molecule. Of course, your instinct is to say, "You drink the whole cup! I got up at 3 in the morning! Of course, you know you'll have to be up another hour and change the bed if you do that, right? So, okay. So, but you see, at that age, he's not really cognizant of you and your needs and your wants and your desires and everything else. He's thirsty. That's it. Abba, I want, you know, that's it. Obviously, my oldest, who's 20, right, so he's not going to be doing this, but if he would wake up in the middle of the night and say, "Abba," and I say, "What do you want?" Right, he'd say, "I'm thirsty." I'd say, "Get the beer yourself. Leave me alone, buddy." Right? Obviously, at age 20, he's got to be at a level where, you know, you expect normal maturity is to become more aware of other people. Unfortunately, though, there has to be encouraged. There are people who grow up who are much older than 20 who are not really aware of other people. Many of them drive on the roads here in New Jersey, right? without an awareness of your existence, and that's, you know, nothing personal, right? But yes, you have to become aware of the other person. Very important part of refinement. So that has to be tutored. Has to be taught. Much of Judaism, I would say about a third of Judaism, are what we call mitzvot, bein adam lechavero, the commandments that govern our relationship with other people. Commandments, laws that make us and help us to become more aware of the other person's existence, more in tune with the other person's existence. And very, very, so that's what could be more central than that in terms of life. And we say the ultimate level of that is what we call gemilut chasadim, which is kindness. Acting with giving, being a giver. Very, very central. Because really, as Rav Dessa says, the world's population can be divided more or less into givers and takers. There are people out there giving, and there are people out there taking. And it's interesting, you cannot necessarily see it by the action. In other words, sometimes a person might be giving something and really be a taker. I say to them, "Oh, nice tie. Can I borrow $5? Right? Am I a giver or a taker? Gave you a compliment. Right? So someone invites me, right, to a wedding. I was invited to a wedding of a student. Actually, I'd never met him. It was a guy who I came in contact with through Ask the Rabbi about 6 years ago. He was asking me questions. Eventually, after a couple of years, he decided when he finished his initial part of college, he went to a yeshiva and we corresponded. He would ask me questions. I guided him which yeshiva to go to and stuff, studied in Israel, came back, did his graduate degree, did more study. And this was after 6 years. Never met the guy. It was a student of mine, right? Just email and internet. And it was about 6 months ago, I get an email from him to invite me to his wedding. I said, "This is cool." So I went to the wedding. I met him for the first time, right, which is very, very nice. And now, at the wedding, let's say he paid 30, or his parents or whoever it was, $30 a plate. So I went to the wedding. Okay, it was a schlep. It was an hour and a half drive. I had to cancel a class, right? I didn't see my kids that day. Went straight from Manhattan to the wedding, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, would you say that I'm a taker or a guy? I don't know. I felt that coming to the wedding was more giving than taking. Granted, I ate 30, actually proves it was a smorgasbord, so probably a lot more than $30 worth. But okay, like, let's leave that aside. I'm not going to get into that sort of details of my eating habit. Right, but nevertheless, I think in a sense, I was giving more than I was taking. You know, one of my kids does carpentry. When he was little, he used to do stuff. You know, he'd come back from carpentry classes in Israel, so he used to go to a carpentry class, the local, what they call Matnas or JCC in Israel. So he comes back and he gives me something. "This is for you, Abba." I look at it and I say, You know, now my attitude was, what the heck is this? No idea. It was like some like object dropped here by a UFO, right? I did not know what the use of this is. Some bizarre technology. No, I did not tell him that, right? I said, thank you so much, Smully. How do I use it, right? And then hopefully, you know, he'll explain to me what I do with it. It's inevitably a paperweight, right? Evidently, he feels there's hurricanes blowing through my office, right? There's like, I have so many paperweights. Right. Now, when I take that from him, I'm not a taker, I'm a giver. In the sense that accepting that gift graciously is really doing much more for him than for me. Right? Much more for him than for me. A, I pay for the carpentry class, for his clothing, for his education, for his food, right? The whole worth. So you know, how much is that wood worth, which I paid for as well? I mean, it's like, so I'm saying that there's, you can be taking and really be a giver. You could be a giver and really be taking. So if I'm only giving because I want my name up in lights, not, you know. So that's the first principle: refinement of my relationship to others, primarily by becoming what we call a giving person. Giving person. And the same, by the way, as I said in love, we talk about loving the salmon. You know, it was so that type of love. When I say I love fish, I love salmon. What type of love is that? That's taking. What can I get from the salmon? What can I get from her? What can I get from him? What can I get? Right? Real love is what can I give? If I love someone, the person I want to give to. Right? The Kabbalists say that's the concept of a kiss. The concept of a kiss is exactly that. Rabbeinu Bachai, 12th century Kabbalist, when he talks about it, the first time a kiss is mentioned in the Torah is I think it's Jacob kissing Yitzhak kissing Rivka, I don't remember, or Jacob kissing Rachel, I think it is, right? So he explains there, he says, because it is the desire to give your very life breath to the other person. You love someone, I want to give everything, my very life, to that other person. That's what ultimately it is. It's the desire to give my very breath. In English, by the way, we talk about what is it called? CPR. Well, it's called kiss of life, right? The breath of, right? Kiss of life, when you do CPR, the type of thing, right? So, That's the basic idea. So that is number one. That's number one. To be a giver in all of those senses. Number two is to develop a relationship with my own soul. As we said, the refinement of the soul. My own soul. Because there are people who might go through life only dealing with the material side. There was a great American thinker and politician known as Jesse Ventura, who is the governor of the state of Minnesota. Right? And interestingly enough, he was not known as Jesse the Soul Ventura, Jesse the Psyche Ventura, Jesse the Mind Ventura, right? He was called Jesse the Body Ventura, right? Madonna, before she did tshuva, used to refer to herself as the material girl, right? The material girl, right? Because indeed it was materialism, which was all what it's all about. Right? So, and there are many people who go through life only facing or only confronting or thinking in terms of the material side, a materialist. Very, very sad way to look at the world, only on the material side. Instead of saying to your wife, I love you, dear, you say, my neurons are sparking off due to the various chemical instincts of the selfish gene and the desire to propagate and consequently create a greater survival of my genes, giving me pleasant sensations on seeing you. Right, I don't know. You know, I mean, I suppose if your wife's an evolutionary biologist, this might turn her on. I don't know. But on the whole, this is not right. So there's a soul, and to ignore the soul is to ignore an entire segment of the person, an entire segment of what we're about. There's very little in terms of survival that is required in terms of art and philosophy and literature and prayer and things like that and poetry, right? That's not survival stuff. You know, animals, right, will be content not to think about any of these things. I had a dog for 13 years, Labrador Cocker Spaniel Cross, now known as a designer breed, then known as a mongrel. But he was very content to spend his life becoming one with the carpet, and depending on the season, moving closer to the air conditioner or the heating vent. Right, that was basically it. Right, I mean, he never once woke up and contemplated, why? Why am I a dog? What is this fascination with the bone? Right, with smells. I mean, I don't. Yeah, so he doesn't think that. No angst. No. Nothing. Right, doesn't bother him. These questions, existential questions, don't bother him. Right, and so the human being, however, has a soul. So for someone whose highest level in life, whose ultimate achievement would be having their car selected by MTV for Pimp My Ride, right, is not someone you can talk to about the soul, right? I mean, someone who measures achievement and how many blue lights you can stick on the stupid car, right, or how large a flat-screen television I get into the back of the Hummer is difficult to talk to, right, so that I can watch it when I'm in the jacuzzi there, right? So it's really difficult to talk to them, right, about anything beyond that, right, because they're only concerned with the material. Right, and we believe in Judaism that there are tremendous, and so I would say also there's the second section of the commandments are the commandments designed to enhance my being in touch with my own soul, being in touch with my own soul, moments, times of quiet and meditation where we're not involved in the rat race, which the rats almost always win, right, and times, so that's one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is the study of Torah, that what we're ostensibly doing now, right? The study of Torah to get in contact with who I really am and the essence of the soul. And there are many commandments, maybe sitting in the sukkah, right? There's a lot of ideas like that where I'm out of the house and I realize that, you know what, maybe it's not the house that makes me who I am, and it's not the car, and it's not anything else, and the fact that I don't have a ceiling, I'm in connection with God. I mean, there's a lot of areas of Judaism which are focused. Fasting on Yom Kippur, one day where I totally, there's one day a year we totally ignore the body. We pretend that we are only a soul. That's that one day of the year, Yom Kippur. That's the idea, right? I'm not eating, I'm not drinking, I'm ignoring the physical side. And in a sense, there was a great Hasidic rabbi who was asked, one of his opponents had circulated rumors that he did not fast on Yom Kippur. And someone asked him, is it true that you don't fast on Yom Kippur? He says, yes, that's true. I said, I can't, you? He said, of course. He says, but he said, I don't fast on Yom Kippur, but who could think of eating on Yom Kippur? Who could think? Who's got time to eat? In other words, he didn't fast because he looked in the book and says, okay, don't eat. It was like he's so involved in the care of the soul, at least that one day of the year, he couldn't even think of eating. So someone else asked him, what about Tisha B'Av, the day we mourn this exile, the destructions of the temple, the temples, etc.? He says, do you fast? He says, no, I don't fast then, but who can enjoy food on Tisha B'Av? So for him, it was totally harmonious with what Judaism was saying. And it was a way of getting in contact with one's own soul. And that would be the second area. And it's so tragic when a person is not in contact with that. And the third area is enhancing and refining our relationship with God, with the Creator. We believe that human beings need to pray. Remember, I was in the army in Israel many years ago. And my son actually is just enlisted now. 20-year-old. So it's, as my wife says, this is great. At least it will improve our prayers. So that's for sure. A few more grey hairs. But anyway, but when I was in the army, so I remember we were in the base. The base was in Bethlehem, actually. Bethlehem. Now Palestinian Authority. So-called Palestinian so-called authority. But in any case, right, we're in this base and there was one, the doctor on the base was saying Kaddish for his father. So he was in the first 12 months of saying Kaddish, first year of his father's passing away, and he was saying Kaddish. So he needed a minion. So he's the doctor. So he was able to get eight medics. There were eight medics there. Seven medics on the base. So he was their commander. He says, get in there, we're going to dub him. Right, so they said, okay, sir, yes, sir. Right, so only in Israel. So anyway, they get into he needs another two people. So I was the rabbi of the base, so obviously I went, right? And then there was a paratrooper, one of some elite Sayeret of the recon units, the Israeli commander, special forces, right? And he was an advanced paramedic in Sayeret, in one of the Sayeret units, one of the recon units. He was giving some advanced course in field medicine. And so I asked, would you like to join us for a minyan? And he says, I don't need to pray. Points to his paratrooper wings, right? He says, I don't need to pray, I got these. I said, could be. I said, but the other guy needs to say Kaddish for his father. It would help us if he just stood there. I said, no, you don't have to pray. Don't say a word, just stand there with us. And he said, okay, besed. Right, so he walks in. Yeah, okay, fine. Yeah. So he walks in like, you know, he's standing there. So there's nine of us praying and he's standing there like, you know, like smoking, right? Like I say, if you smoke, you need to pray. Anyway, but I did notice that when it came to appropriate parts, he would say, "Amen." Couldn't hold himself back. Amen, Yeheshmei Rabba Mavor. He said Amen. He responded. Deep down, I believe that we all need to pray, right? Sometimes only comes out at times, you know, but prayer, which is contact with God, is a constant need. And not only in the bad times. When things go well, how many times do we, you know, go through a day and this went well? You know, generally, unfortunately, we only think about the things that went badly in a day. We don't think about the things that went well today, right? Oh, this is good. This worked out. It's always great to like a little calculation. This worked out. It's just that one thing that doesn't work out, that's what we think about. In Judaism, we have prayers. We have blessings when we drink, when we eat. Why? Because I appreciate what I have. Very, very important. Part of my relationship. Someone gives me something, I say gratitude. Thank you. Right? So God grants me all these amazing things. Life, existence, etc., etc. Right? I praise him and I actually say thank you for each one of those things because that's part of a relationship. Part of a relationship is talking, communication. Right? And prayer is not just about kvetching. A lot of people think of prayer as kvetching, right? You know, like, oh, can I have this? Can I have that? That type of thing, you know? I mean, but that doesn't make sense because according to Maimonides, it's actually a biblical command to pray every day. Now, let's say you're on a road trip. We took a road trip with my family to Atlanta. Well, at least four of the kids, right? But we went to Atlanta. So it's like a 14-hour drive. We stopped on the way. You know, can you imagine you're in the road trip, right? And none of the kids are kvetching. So you turn around and say, if I don't hear someone complaining, I'm going to stop this car right now. Who'd be crazy enough to do that? You out of your mind? You want the kids to kvetch? So what do you mean? God wants us to kvetch? God says, hey, I don't hear anyone complaining. I want you to kvetch every day. I mean, that's clearly not what it is. Prayer is much more of an establishment of a relationship, communication. For example, right, you send a kid away to college or whatever, right, make the mistake of giving him a credit card, right, and you don't hear from them. Nothing. Right, so imagine the parent, you don't hear no phone calls, no emails, no. You phone, you get some bizarre message on their dorm telephone, like, you know, leave a message after the primal scream or that type of garbage, right, and never hear back from. So you go to the bank, you say, listen, I'd like to cancel this credit card. 2 hours later, hi Dad, how are you? Whoa, how are you? About the credit card. Listen, I want to find out how you're doing. I'm married now, but that's not important. The credit card, right, so, you know, there is a desire that God has for a relationship with us. And so, and indeed, we believe also the soul has a desire for a relationship with God. And really, that would be the other third of the commandments, to enhance our relationship with the Creator, with God, the appreciation of that relationship. So that's it. That's Judaism in a nutshell. That which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your soul, unto God, unto others. In other words, develop, enhance, and be aware of your relationship with God, with other people, with your own soul. Right, and do that and work on that in all those different ways. The rest is commentary, indeed it is. All the commandments are commentaries on that. Whether they are bein adam l'chaverah, between a person and their friend, whether they are bein adam l'makom, between a person and God, or whether they are bein adam l'atzmo, between a person and themselves, in all of those, they're commentaries on that great and central principle. And as he finishes by saying, the rest is commentary, go and learn. And that's what I tell you. So that's it for today. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank Rabbi Becker.